This is 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and my guest is Dr. Tom Kazee, who is retiring as the 23rd president of the University of Evansville. So, Dr. Kazee, welcome. And does that presidential count go all the way back to Moores Hill College?
Yeah, I've never actually been to Moores Hill to see what it was like, but it does. We have a long history going back to mid-19th century, and so coming here as president, it was a chance for me to build on that foundation, that historical foundation of excellence.
I think 1854, is the establishment date.
Right.
And then the school moved to Evansville like in the teens.
Yep, that's right. And Benjamin Bossy, the mayor, had a lot to do with that and securing the funds. It's a great story. They were raising money and hadn't yet hit the goal and were getting near the deadline where they had to have the money raised by and to build Olmsted Hall, which is now still the key building on campus. And he put together a group of people in town who cared deeply about bringing the university to Evansville, and they raised the money, and the rest, as they say, is history.
I'm a graduate, and when I started there, it was still Evansville College for at least one quarter, and then it switched to university. Dr. Melvin Hyde was the president then,
right.
And I think Dr. Graves succeeded him.
That's right.
Now, both you and Dr. Linda Bennett, who is the president of the University of Southern Indiana, both announced your retirements not too far apart. Merely coincidence, I understand.
It is a coincidence. Linda's a good friend. I've known her since literally the day I arrived. And we're both political scientists, as you mentioned. And so as a result of that, I had known her work. Her field of work was similar to my own, actually, as it turned out. And so when I came here, it was a really pleasant surprise to realize that I would have across town another college president who not only shared my interest in academic leadership, but also in our field in political science.
Now, both of you are retiring with your institutions really gaining some momentum. I know a lot of things going on at USI. Of course, U of E has got a lot going on, too. You've got a new president coming in. You've got a new basketball coach. You've got some new buildings up, and the Hyde Hall is being renovated.
Mm-hmm. We've done a lot, especially in the last few years. We've renovated our library, which is now a really terrific space. Students just love it. Total renovation of the library. We're doing a total renovation of Hyde Hall, which is the main classroom building on campus. As you mentioned, we've built going back about 6 or 7 years, we built a new basketball practice facility, which was necessitated with the raising of our previous, of course, Roberts Stadium, which was near and dear to the hearts of many folks in Evansville. And now probably the development that is especially exciting, which both USI and UE are parties to, and that's the building of the Evansville Health Science Center here in downtown Evansville. And we'll have several of our programs there. USI will have some of its programs. And Indiana University will have its Indiana University Med School Evansville located there. It's a game changer for the city and for the partner schools.
I think you hit that right on the nail on the head there. It is going to be a game changer, especially for downtown Evansville. We've already seen the effects of this school. It hasn't even opened yet. Businesses opening down here and people looking at downtown now to expand. Now, you've been an administrator and a classroom teacher. And do you come from a family of teachers?
I don't, actually. That's a good question, because one always wonders where seeds got planted and why someone did what they did. Actually, my parents were deeply committed to education for their children. I'm the youngest of three children. They themselves didn't have a lot of formal education. But they respected it. They knew that that was the way to improve oneself in life. It really wasn't until I got to college that the prospect of maybe becoming a professor myself began to take root. And it really wasn't that complicated. I just loved the college environment. There was something about it. Ideas mattered. People seemed youthful, even if they were chronologically older. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like a place I wanted to spend my life, my professional life. And so that led to me figuring out what it took to get a graduate degree. I went to Ohio State to do that and have never looked back. It's been a wonderful career.
Now, do you remember what your first day was like when you faced a classroom of students for the first time? You know, where that was at?
I do. I remember it very well, actually. In grad school, there were teaching assistants and research assistants. I was a research assistant, so I didn't have classroom teaching experience in grad school, as some grad students do. Mm-hmm. But my last year at Ohio State, I was offered an opportunity to go to a small college in southwestern Ohio, Wilmington College. It's 70 miles from Columbus, something like that, to teach a public policy class. They just needed someone to come and teach one class in the evenings. And I remember walking into that first day of class. I was about one chapter in the book ahead of my students because public policy wasn't an area that I had been studying myself. I had to get up to speed. And many of these students were adult students, which turned out to be a blessing because they were very supportive of this, you know, fresh-faced, inexperienced, and probably somewhat insecure professor that they had. They helped me a lot through that first class. But I remember the apprehension. I also remember the excitement. And I knew I had chosen the right vocation, but I also knew it was going to take a lot of work to get good at it. So yeah, that first day, it feels like it happened yesterday.
Now, your degrees are in political science. So what got you hooked on making sense of how our government works or maybe doesn't work?
You know, it's funny. When I'm asked that question, I always think back to my days, believe it or not, as a paper boy. I grew up in the Cleveland, Ohio area, and I delivered the Cleveland Press, which is no longer in existence.
I was going to say the Plain Dealer.
That's right. Well, the Plain Dealer was the morning paper, and the Press was the afternoon paper.
They used to have an afternoon paper here, which was called the Press.
Well, most cities of any size had a morning and afternoon paper. And I was one of those people who would, you know, delivering papers isn't the most intellectually challenging thing to do. So I would read the paper as I delivered it. I was a walking paper boy. I literally walked from house to house and put the paper in the front door. A lot of time to read. I was surprised I didn't walk out in front of a truck or something. but I remember just and the easiest section to read is the front page when you're delivering papers, because then you don't have to mess with getting into the sections. So I started reading a lot of current events. And I remember being fascinated by it, being really interested in it. And that led to my interest in studying history, studying economics, and then ultimately political science.
So how did you end up at the University of Evansville?
I was the provost, which is the number two position at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. I was in my seventh year there. Was very happy there. My wife was the dean of a magnet school for the performing arts called the Governor's School for the Arts and Humanities in Greenville. We were assuming we'd probably spend the rest of our careers there. And as it happens these days, I got an email. And it was from a search firm that the university had hired to help it identify a pool of candidates for their presidency. Steve Jennings, my predecessor, had announced he was retiring. And my first response to the email was, I'm not interested. I knew of the reputation of UE. I knew it was a very good reputation, but I wasn't interested in relocating. And the search consultant, being good at his job, said, don't say no. Just let me send you some things. And he sent me materials. And the more I read about UE and the more I talked to other people who knew Evansville, who knew the signature programs there, the more fascinated I became. The search committee then invited Sharon, my wife, and I up to Indianapolis for an extended interview. And she has always been deeply appreciative of the fact that they included her in the conversation, because we've always thought of ourselves as a team. And I remember leaving that interview thinking, I hope this wasn't yet to the finalist stage. And I said, I hope they invite us to campus. Well, a few days after that, I got a call saying we'd love for you and Sharon to visit campus. We loved it. The day we walked onto campus was a warm spring day. Students were throwing frisbees out on the sort of common area. And I remember turning to the search committee chair and said, how much did you pay all of these people? It looked almost too perfect. You know, it was what a small college should feel like. And they really won us over. And so then I remember leaving that thinking, I hope they offer the job. And they did, and so we were thrilled about coming to Evansville.
Yeah, there are some idyllic moments when you walk on the U of E campus on those spring days when people are out and on the quads and everything. Yeah, it's a beautiful campus. So do you and your wife, Sharon, have any immediate plans when you retire?
Our most immediate plan is to spend some time with our grandchildren. We have a daughter who lives in Chicago. And she and her husband have twin four-year-olds, a boy and a girl. And last July, when I called my daughter, Nicole, and I said, you know, your brother and I have been talking about this, and we've decided this is going to be our last year at UE. She said, oh, Dad, congratulations. I think it's a wonderful thing. And there was maybe a 3-second pause, and she said, "We're going to be out of the country next July. Would you watch the kids for us?" So I got immediately indoctrinated into what it's going to be like to be a retired grandparent.
Oh, it has begun.
And so that's our immediate plans. And then we have other travel we like to do. Both of us have a whole array of interests, which we can now follow up on more than we've been able to so far.
This is 2 Main Street, and we are talking to Dr. Tom Kazee, who is retiring as president of the University of Evansville after 8 years leading the school. You were talking about Sharon, and she's also an educator, and I know you said that she has been very active in the arts, and I assume she still is.
She is. As a matter of fact, the challenge she's faced is that she's been deeply engaged in the community and is on a number of boards. And at some point she realized she was starting to say yes to so many invitations to be on boards that she always wants to be able to give good service to the boards that she's on. But she's been on the Philharmonic and the Arts Council and has just been involved with a lot of things happening in Evansville. And that's one of the things that makes leaving bittersweet. We've made many friends. Sharon is, and many of her friends are different than my friends in the nature of our work. They overlap. Mm-hmm. But she's really established herself as someone who's been committed to Evansville being a great place to live. And that makes leaving a little harder. So she's saying quite a number of goodbyes these days.
Now, of course, you are a political junkie, obviously a political scientist. Is she also a political junkie?
Not as much, mm-hmm. but is very, I would describe her as very well informed. Partly it's, you know, living in a house where I've taught for many years, and even now, just today, I taught a class over on campus. And so she is one of those people who I will come home and say, "Did you see the news story about, or have you read the article about?" And I find her to be a wonderful sounding board, mm-hmm. Because in many ways she reflects what an engaged citizen is like. I think she's fair-minded. She doesn't look at everything through just a kind of partisan filter. But she wants this to be a great country and a great state and a great community. And so she's kept herself very well informed about those things.
Well, I think you may have mentioned this earlier, but what are you going to miss most about this community?
That's easy, the people. From the very first day that we met with that search committee and then our visit to campus, and ever since, the warmth, the support, folks have strong opinions, as they should, and they're not afraid to voice them, but they do so in a way that reflects a kind of responsible understanding of how decisions have to get made. This has been a place, and I've often attributed this to a kind of Midwestern quality, and I grew up in Ohio. Had been out of the region for a long time, but when we came back, what we loved is the fact that what you see is what you get with people. They shoot straight with you. And so we've made many friends. Friendships will, of course, last long beyond our leaving the university. Folks who we look forward to now being able to spend a little more time in a less professional context, more a friendship context.
Now, when you first arrived, of course, you have to learn about the community. Did you hear about the Fall Festival? Did they brief you on that?
I did. I heard about it a lot. And as it happened, our chief financial officer at the university at the time, a fellow named Jeff Wolf, was very much involved with the festival. And he told me all about the Nut Club, and he told me about the festival. And so we went that first year. And I'm still probably trying to dissolve all the fried foods that I ate that first year. But I love that sort of thing. And so when my wife and I go back, we wonder what are they going to fry differently this year? And there's just a wonderful feel to it. It's what every great street festival should have. Sense of everybody, whatever their station in life, they come together, they enjoy the company, they enjoy they have pride in the fact that this is a festival that is really well known, mm-hmm. I think, throughout the region. It's so distinctly Evansville.
That's right. It is. It's one of our signature events. And what is your favorite or maybe least favorite fall festival food?
Wow. Well, my wife will tell you that we used to have a tradition in our family. We on the Friday after Thanksgiving, it is a Friday after all, so we'd call it Friday. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that we'd fry a turkey on Thanksgiving Thursday, and then we'd have all of this peanut oil left over. So on Friday, we'd fry Snickers bars and, you know, banana slices. We'd fry all sorts of things. So coming here, it felt quite natural that I would eat fried things. I do, I have to say, I kind of like fried Snickers bars because it sort of emulsifies the chocolate and the nuts and in the sort of fried, the crunchiness of that shell. Mm-hmm. Probably not at all good for you, but very tasty.
Now, of course, you lived in the Carolinas, and of course, the Carolinas, they brag about their barbecue. Mm-hmm. And of course, you come to this area, and it claims to be the barbecue capital of the world. Mm-hmm. Of course, Owensboro has that title. So how do you rate the barbecues?
Oh, I think the barbecue is very good here. In the Carolinas, as you say, they have a variety of barbecue. One of the kinds is really a vinegary kind of barbecue. Then there's a mustardy one, and then there's one with a little more of a sort of spicy, tomato-y kind of, you know, sauce. But I think the barbecue is very good. And I'm not too picky. I like barbecue, and so depending on the mood at a given time, I like different kinds. But I think the barbecue here is quite good.
I just had to throw that in there. Okay, now let's back to what's going on campus. A new president is taking over the reins as president of the University of Evansville this summer. And what should we know about Christopher Petruskevich?
Well, I think the first thing you should know is that I think he's going to hit the ground running. He is a very genuine person, as is his wife. Sharon and I had a chance.
Siobhan, is it?
Yeah, Siobhan. We had a chance to meet them. I met with him individually, and we talked mostly sort of about the business of the university. And then Sharon and I had a chance to dine with them, talk about they have two children, talk about the schools in the area. And I came away from that meeting thinking, I don't know exactly where the Board of Trustees will land, but this is somebody who I think is capable of doing a very good job. There's an unpretentiousness about him, but he's very intelligent. He struck me as being a very good listener, asked a lot of good questions. I'm very upbeat about it. Obviously, any outgoing president wants to be sure that his or her successor
Sure.
is going to come in and continue to build the excellence of the university, and I have no doubt about that at all with Chris.
Now, he's a legal background, right?
Mm-hmm. He is. He's the dean of the law school at Stetson University, but what makes – which is in Florida – what makes Chris a little different maybe than most deans of a professional school is that Stetson moved their law school from DeLand, which is where the main campus is, to Fort Lauderdale. They actually, I think, have a couple of places now, but I think primarily in Fort Lauderdale, which means that he is operating really as the chief executive officer where he is. The structure there is such that most of the things that a president does, he already does. And he affected that transition really beautifully. Every person that I've talked to says that law school is doing quite well, and a lot of it is due to his leadership. So he brings not only, I think, an understanding. Stetson is a school very much like UE, a liberal arts and sciences foundation with professional schools, the law school being one of those. So I think he gets us. He understands what we're about, but he also has that leadership experience that bodes well for him being an effective president.
Did I get the pronunciation right, Petruskevich?
That's the way I pronounce it. Let's hope we're both right.
We're not going to spell it, but anyway. Just ahead, we're going to talk politics with Dr. Tom Kazee, the influence of special interest groups on our lawmaking process. There used to be a slogan, "The Russians are coming." Well, are they already here? And the surge of student involvement in our electoral system. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and my guest is Dr. Tom Kazee, who is retiring as the 23rd president of the University of Evansville. Dr. Kazee is a political science professor and the author of Who Runs for Congress? Ambition, Context, and the Candidate. And one of the issues you bring up is the question, why good people do or don't run for Congress. What's that all about?
Well, you know, when I was doing research in graduate school on American elections, I noticed that there was in that area of Central Ohio U.S. House election that was the same two candidates running against each other in the previous election. And I was wondering how frequently that occurred. And it turned out I ended up writing my dissertation about that phenomenon. I call it the rerun phenomenon. And what I, as I dove deeper into that, what I learned is that the reason why most incumbents win re-election is not just because of what they've done or didn't do. It's because they don't always face very effective opposition. And so if you're looking at the incumbent and you're trying to decide whether you want to keep him or her in office, it's rational to say, yeah, but if we didn't vote for him or her, who would replace him? And if the challenger isn't someone who you have much confidence in, then you're probably going to default to vote for the incumbent. So that fascinated me. What is it about American elections, about the competitive context?
It's kind of like the fear of the unknown.
Well, it's partly, and a lot of, I mean, running for political office these days, part of my dissertation was interviewing a large number of candidates. I interviewed Newt Gingrich, by the way, at the time, when he was an unsuccessful House candidate. Fascinating interview in those days. But what they tell you is that I interviewed both people who ran and those who were identified as potentially strong candidates who didn't run. And those interviews were in some senses the most interesting. And what they said is it's expensive. It can be exhausting and draining. There's a lot of these days politics being a bare-knuckles sport. You know, are you willing to jump into the arena and know you're going to get a lot of criticism from the other side? There's no guarantee of winning. You have to step away from your career. And for women candidates, it was particularly problematic in that for them, many of them, given the way our culture has evolved, had more pronounced child-caring responsibilities than husbands did. I think that's changing in a positive way now. But nevertheless, it did have an effect on them running. So what I concluded is that one of the drivers of the incumbents winning re-election was simply the absence of strong opposition.
Well, you take all those factors together, and that's kind of narrows the pool mm-hmm. of potential candidates. So you're a smaller and smaller group that would run for office and make our laws.
Well, if you think about here in our district, in the 8th District, Congressman Bouchon, who's now been in office a number of years, and because of that, he has the ability to raise funds. And this would be true of Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservative, that allows him to run a very strong reelection campaign. And you might say, well, that all that means is that when you get down to November, he has certain advantages. The problem is, by the time you get to November, he may have little serious opposition because those who might have been stronger challengers have opted out of the process somewhere along the way. Going back to the founding, James Madison wrote that in the Federalist Papers, he talked about the essential need for competition. There needs to be a landscape in which real competition can occur, and through that competition, the strongest candidates will likely emerge. And as you say, they make our laws, so we're likely to get more effective lawmaking. And anything that distorts that, which I think is one of the consequences we have in an environment that doesn't encourage people to run for office, actually actively discourages many from running, has a consequence of a less effective structure for making law.
Well, I dug up a quote here from, we'll tell you the author of this quote here in a minute. One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. And that warning came from the Greek philosopher Plato.
Right.
What still rings true?
Well, you know, the bumper sticker that says if you don't like education, try ignorance, or some paraphrase of that. Well, I think that's similar, somewhat analogous to this, is that if we don't have good people who are willing to try, who are willing to run for office, then you don't have that high level of competition, that, regardless of who wins in the end, that's going to produce somebody committed to public service, someone who has an understanding of the complexity of issues. And I don't mean to disparage elective officials in general. We actually have, I think, on balance, a government that has a very large number of public-spirited people. But we, I think, would be well served if more people participated. And that means not just running for office, but also voting and expressing their preferences in campaigns. Our culture is a little apolitical. It's not non-political. It's just people have other things to do with their lives, and I understand that. But engagement in the political process ultimately is critical for us having an effective government.
Got another quote here. We're talking to Tom Kazee. He's retiring as president of the University of Evansville. We're talking politics, and this quote is from an unlikely source. Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. And that's from Groucho Marx, not Karl Marx.
Well, Okay, at the other end of that continuum, and I won't get the quote exactly right, but Winston Churchill, at one point in his career, said something to this effect. In life, there are people who deal with the toughest problems. They address problems that sometimes seem impossible to solve. They take responsibility for coming up with those solutions, and they live or die with the consequences. We call those people politicians. And I think I worry about the pejorative kind of baggage that we associate with the word politician. We need politicians. We need people committed to public service. And that's what politicians do, which is not to say that all politicians are doing a great job. I worry that sometimes if we paint with this brush, mm-hmm. That sort of taints all of those who have ambition. Ambition is critical. We need to have people who are ambitious for public office. And if we decide their ambition is misdirected, then we should vote somebody else into office. But the best way to stay in office is to do a good job.
Right.
And so that's what we want. We want people who are committed to run, and once they get in office, do the kind of job that makes us want to keep them there.
Now, you've also studied a public opinion of not only Congress, but also the presidency. It sounds like there's, a large group. I know there's a large group out there. They're just not quite too keen on what our Congress is up to. They just don't think they're doing a good job. They just don't see anything accomplished. And I know that's sad, too, because we want to get those good people in there and keep them in there.
Well, it is true that there's a lot of cynicism, apathy, in some cases anger at government, and a lot of it is well-placed. I think what people do need to look at is how the American government was designed. The founders, who were very much afraid of tyranny, after all, the revolution was about the tyranny of a king. The founders were very much committed to creating a governmental system that had these checks and balances that we've all learned about from, our civics classes or even our history classes in school. But checks and balances does make it hard to do things. And now, again, it was in part designed to protect against tyranny and demagoguery, that sort of thing. But our system isn't designed to be very efficient. We are, all of that said, I think we're at a moment of particular ineffectiveness. And I think a lot of that has to do with how polarized the environment has become. We just welcomed to campus last week Richard Lugar, former senator from Indiana. And Lugar had a reputation of being someone who could work across the aisle. He could work with Democrats. He was a Republican, but he could work with Democrats. And he mentioned in his comments on campus something that many people comment on is the fact that a tradition of bipartisanship, of working with folks who may disagree with you on some issues but not on every issue, that we're at a nadir of that. We're at a point at which I think somehow that we need to have people who come into office who say, I'm not going to demonize my opponent. I'm not going to say the only answers are those that pass some ideological litmus test. But we need to, if the other side, as it were, comes up with a solution that we think is worth trying, well, then let's go ahead and give it a shot. And I think we have had periods of time in American history when there's been more of a tradition of that. I think when I first started studying politics, that was more true than it is today. So I do worry. I do worry about the fact that the question, how long will this polarization run? Will the pendulum start to swing back the other direction? I suspect it will. If American history is any guide, it's just a question of how long that's going to take.
On the other end of that spectrum, you talked about Senator Lugar. He's a Republican. Lee Hamilton, a Democrat, I think he represents that compromise. He was a diplomat, too. Right. I mean, I think he'd get along with both sides. And he's an Evansville native, Lee Hamilton. And I had a chance to interview him in Washington on his last few months in office, and very impressed with his grasp of what's going on. And I know he's still very active in the political process.
Well, he and Lugar, I've had the good fortune of meeting both of them. We've given both of them honorary degrees at UE. I think they represent almost a kind of archetype, almost an idealized form of the public servant. And to me, the proof of that is not just their careers when they were in elective office, but what they've done after they left office. They continue to be involved in opportunities or efforts to encourage good governance. They continue to be involved in efforts to encourage bipartisanship. And it's very genuine. When you talk to either of them, it's clear that they see that as ultimately the answer to much of what ails the United States. And that kind of model is something, my own opinion, is we need more of.
I also got a chance to interview Senator Wendell Ford when he was the Senate, I think, minority whip. And he was
a
whip.
That's right, right.
Up in the Capitol. He had this beautiful office in his, he had his own private elevator, so he had a really nice office. Big picture of Henry Clay on the wall, and the compromiser. And he was talking about the spirit of that, too. And so those guys are no longer up there. But hopefully their legacy will continue with some new candidates. And we have people that are getting interested in politics. I know students are getting more involved now, too. We've seen the activism on this gun safety issue. So, and will they show up for the midterms? That's
well,
a good question.
Yeah, especially midterm elections, turnout is a key because turnout is typically very low in midterm elections. I do expect that what we've seen in the kind of growing activity, especially sort of triggered by but not exclusively due to the Parkland shootings and the students' response to that, whatever one's opinion is of those issues, I think having young people who see the relevance of politics, whatever side of the divide they're on, that I think can't help but be good for the system. It will require elected officials to be accountable to folks who are paying attention. And if you don't think folks are paying attention, I mean, that's, you know, sunshine is a great antiseptic. You know, we let the sunshine in, people know what's going on. So it's tragic that it had to be such a horrific event that stimulated this kind of activism. But I think on balance, we're going to find that to be a very positive thing.
Have you ever considered running for public office? I asked Dr. Linda Bennett that, and she just, no.
Yeah. Well, probably when I was – if you had asked me what I wanted to be when I was in high school, I probably would have said a U.S. senator. And by the time I got to grad school, I said, I want to study U.S. senators. I don't want to be one. And I say that only half jokingly. One of the byproducts of studying the political process is you do realize what it means to commit yourself to that life. And compare it to what else you might do with your life. And once it became clear to me that I was passionate about teaching, and then later passionate about higher education in general, any sort of teenage dreams of being in public office quickly went away. I do enjoy being having some kind of proximity to the process. I just don't want to do it as I worked on Capitol Hill for a year, for example, when I had a sabbatical year, and I found that to be immensely enlightening. But again, all it did was confirm for me I didn't ever want to be an elected official.
What did you do on Capitol Hill?
I spent the first half of the year. It's a program that's sponsored by the American Political Science Association. They're called Congressional Fellows. And so it's a competitive program, and those who are selected get to go up on Capitol Hill for a year. I spent the first half of the year working in the House of Representatives for a subcommittee. It was called the Subcommittee on Telecommunications and Finance. And a lot of the issues we hear now about the internet, about even things like who controls the spectrum, the broadcast spectrum, those were all the issues that we dealt with. And then the second half of the year, I had an opportunity to shift over to the Senate side. And I worked in the office of a senator named Tom Daschle, who eventually became the majority leader in the Senate. When I was working for him, he was a freshman senator from South Dakota. And so I saw it both from the side of the committee structure, and then I saw it from the side of the personal office structure, and saw both sides, the House and Senate. It was the candy store.
I bet.
If you're a political scientist, there's just nothing better you can do than do a fellowship on Capitol Hill. It allowed me to come back to my teaching with, I think, frankly, a more nuanced understanding of how the process works.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Tom Kazee, the University of Evansville president, retiring after 8 years on the job. Okay, we're going to talk about special interest groups and how they are affecting how laws are made. A lot of comment on that. What's your opinion?
Well, one of the things I mentioned being on Capitol Hill, one would have to see how legislation gets made to understand the role of special interest groups, both from a negative and a positive perspective. You know the old line about two things you don't want to see made, sausage and legislation. Right. Well, the legislative process, frankly, depends on interest groups. And here's why. Because legislators need information. And special interest groups basically are purveyors. That's what they traffic in, information. And so if there's a bill that would be designed to regulate a new drug, the Food and Drug Administration has its own data, but the pharmaceutical manufacturers have their own data. And so Congress operates in a way to bring those sources of information together. And so you might have the bureaucratic perspective from the FDA, you've got the special interest perspective from the pharmaceutical companies, and then you might have consumer groups who have their own interest in a drug being made legal or not. They bring in their... So what interest groups do basically is they fill the vacuum of information. And that's a good thing. Now here's where it gets distorted. Not all interest groups are equally able to do that. And so if you're in an area where the information flow is largely, if not controlled, at least overwhelmed by certain groups, then that's when you can get a disproportionate influence on the part of those groups. Add to that the fact that interest groups have financial resources because they can aggregate. That's the point. It's a collection of people with a common interest. They aggregate their interests, and they're able to use those financial resources to contribute to election campaigns. There are laws regulating campaign finance, but interest groups are able to provide an awful lot of money. And so what has happened, and this is partly due to a court decision called Citizens United, it's for shorthand, is that corporations are basically treated as individuals in that their spending of money, and I'm now conflating corporations and interest groups, and that's a little bit oversimplified. But nevertheless, that means their voice is louder. And so you have certain segments, that is those with financial resources, who can speak more loudly than the average person. And that's troubling. So I guess I have a little bit of an ambivalent view about interest mm-hmm. groups. I Congress would have a hard time functioning, even as effectively or ineffectively it is, without that source of information. And by the way, the one thing I was told when I first got to Capitol Hill is, if people think interest groups provide us with a lot of distorted information, they're not thinking about the member's interest. So if you're a member of Congress and an interest group lobbyist comes and meets with you and says, you need to do this because here are the facts, and those facts are wrong, and you act on that information and it blows up in your face, you will effectively, number one, you might not get reelected because of that, but even if you got reelected, you're effectively going to close the door to that lobbyist forever, because you're going to say, you did not provide me with accurate information. It's not to say their information isn't spun in a certain way. It is. But there are some checks built into the process that make it a little harder for interest groups to distort things as much as I think the average person thinks they do. So I'm not an advocate of more interest group money pouring into the process. All I'm saying is that we have to look as objectively as we can about the role that they play. And much of the information they provide is really essential to good public policymaking.
And then you have the some of the bogus information, these shadow groups, like the Russians are generating some of this content, and they put it on the internet, and it gets spun, and people get excited about it, and it gets distorted, and that's a kind of a strange phenomenon that has developed.
One of the things that worries me most about this whole conversation about fake news is that if anything that makes its way into the public arena is inconsistent with your point of view, and if you dismiss that out of hand as saying, well, that's just fake news, our ability to determine what's fact and what's not becomes diminished. Because depending on which side of the aisle on, you'll just reject it out of hand and say that's not a fact, even when it is demonstrably a fact. And so I do worry a lot about with the flood of information sources, with social media, with, as you say, with external agencies like in this case Russia, which has been alleged to be, and I think it's been demonstrated, whether or not the president colluded is a separate issue. There's no doubt, it seems to me, that the Russians have been using American social media to bring certain kinds of information, much of it false, into the public space. And if people pick that up and assume it must be real, they don't know the source of it, then it distorts and corrupts, unfortunately. So I have real concerns about that. Now, how do you solve that? That's another probably discussion. But right now, I worry that information is fine, but if information which is contradictory to your point of view, you just claim isn't true, then truth itself becomes very difficult to discover.
Well, I, as a journalist, I'm very concerned about people watch a certain network to get their point of view and watch another network that supports their point of view. And then who's going to be the person in the middle, the arbiter, the person who's really giving out the facts? And I think a public radio, public television is hopefully filling that void. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about with Dr. Tom Kazee of the University of Evansville about our privately funded universities, our educational system, and the urgent need for qualified and talented teachers. That's one of my passions. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and my guest is Dr. Tom Kazee, who is retiring after 8 years at the helm of the University of Evansville. Now, full disclosure, I am a U of E grad, my wife is a U of E grad, and my daughter is a U of E grad, so we're a U of E family. The campus is always changing, but the school has this legacy of maintaining its core values that have sustained that school all these years.
Well, I'm going to go back to the development office and make sure they have your name in their mailing list, given all those family members.
Yes, and my daughter was a legacy student.
There we go. That's great.
Mm-hmm. So the school is certainly a part of my life. And one of the gyms of the school is actually located thousands of miles away in the countryside of England, Harlaxton College.
Harlaxton College is just one of those things that has to be seen to be believed. When Sharon and I first visited Harlaxton, we had heard so many good things about it. I often say it's a little like hearing somebody, many people telling you the movie, it's a great movie, it's a great movie, it's a great movie. And you think, well, it really can't be that good. And then you go to the movie and it's better than they told you.
Right.
Harlaxton is that way. It has a kind of magic about it. That said, it is a very serious academic program. It's been, I think, deservedly rated the number one study abroad program in the United States. The students who go there live in what is effectively a castle. It's called a manor house, but it's a spectacular manor house, large enough to house about 150 students a semester and faculty and staff all basically in the same manor house, which is quite remarkable. Students there not only take a full array of courses, but they also travel extensively in the British Isles, on the continent. They go to France, Germany, Italy, Spain, some even further afield. The best way to describe Harlaxton is what I've heard many students who've returned from Harlaxton say. I went there as a college student as I came back as an adult. Their self-reliance, their self-confidence grows as a result of their experience there. They also learn what the world, when we say we're living in this new kind of global environment, that's fine to study that here in Indiana, but to experience it. And experience it firsthand is quite remarkable. Many of our students came from small Midwestern towns. They may not have had a chance to travel that much. Harlaxton changes their lives in a very positive way.
And my daughter went there, and I was kind of surprised to learn that some of her roommates were from other colleges, mm-hmm. not from U of E. I think one was from Baker and some other smaller schools. So you attract other students as well.
We do. There are roughly 300 students a year that travel there, about 150 in the fall, 150 in the spring. Sometimes the numbers are skewed one way or the other, but it comes to about 300. And a little over half of those are UE students. What that means, almost half are from what we call partner schools. Western Kentucky has been a significant partner for us. We've had students from DePauw and Wabash and just schools that you would know. We think that's a very important part of the program. We want our students to be exposed not only to the world, but also to people from a variety of places in the world and in the United States. It is a very highly regarded program. We're actually now in the process of recruiting more partner schools who would like their students to have a chance to participate. It's been a very successful program for us.
I know recently on PBS, the miniseries Victoria had Harlaxton as some of the background footage there, and they the carriages would drive by Harlaxton, which was really neat to see that.
And you know, by, really quick, David, the great backstory about that filming there is one of the reasons the producers of the series liked it so much is they didn't have to build any sets. They didn't really have to change anything, interior or exterior, because it shows so beautifully in the form of a kind of, in the day, a sort of French manor house, and that's where it was supposedly set. Mm-hmm. It was in France in the show. So they loved taping there because they didn't have to spend very much money or time in building sets.
Wasn't The Haunting?
Yes.
The horror movie, The Haunting, was
pretty
was
forgettable
there.
Movie, but but it was, and it had a major cast, you know, of people regulars, but it was also done at Harlaxton.
Okay. Now, education, of course, obviously very important to the future of our democracy. We've got to have educated voters out there. Should there be more focus on civics lessons in schools?
Yeah, I do think we need more attention to an understanding of how the political process works. That old notion of civics, I have a certain reservation about because I think many of the people who went through a curriculum like that saw an idealized form of the way the system works. And I think that sometimes leads to cynicism because they think that's the way it's supposed to work, and then they look at the way it actually works and there's a disconnect. That said, it's really troubling to see how many young people come out of high school without understanding even the basic fundamentals of American government. They may understand a little bit about history and some of them even economics and languages, and all those things are appropriate, but not knowing the basic mechanics of American mm-hmm. government is problematic. We wonder why there's not much involvement in the process. A lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that I just don't understand it.
Of course, there's a constant need for qualified teachers at all levels of our educational system. U of E, I know, has been filling that need. The education department gets its students into the classroom early and often.
Mm-hmm. We think that's a critical part of educating teachers. We also are doing some things designed to get more people into the teaching profession. We have several programs that are beyond the traditional recruiting of high school students to go to study in an education program. We have a program designed to take those who graduated with an undergraduate degree in some other field, and now as adults think, you know, teaching might be a good thing for me to do, but they're not certified. They haven't taken the appropriate coursework. They can come back at a very good rate in terms of tuition. They can come back to UE and get their teacher certification so that they can teach. We're also working with high schools to get a sense of what it is they want in terms of the what fields. STEM fields are of great interest now in high schools. We've had a very fine teacher education program for many years. We're being creative and innovative and expanding its reach. Like you, I think, you know, education is the answer. And if we don't have good teachers, we won't have educated people. That's pretty straightforward.
Well, my daughter, now U of E grad, she teaches at one of the local high schools here. And the stories I hear from her, I mean, these teachers have so much on their plate now. Not only the course they're talking about, they have the social problems of the students. Now school safety and a lot of bureaucracy, and a lot of times they use their own money to pay for supplies. So there's a lot going on with the teaching profession, and we just need to support them more and give them what they need. So that's my I'm on my soapbox there. So anyway, last time I was talking to a University of Evansville president face-to-face like this was back when Wallace Graves was president. I was editor of the Crescent, the student newspaper.
Still exists?
Yes. And I had one of my employees, a fellow student, was a cartoonist named Tom Armstrong, who went on to do the Marvin strip, which was nationally syndicated. And he drew a picture. This was like they just announced a tuition increase. So he drew this cartoon of Wallace Graves as this vampire with his cape, with his fangs biting into a student's neck. And so I was called into the president's office, and I thought, oh boy, I'm going to get it. He loved it. He thought it was funny. And he said he was just kind of giving me some of the background about the tuition increase, and most people were on scholarships and everything. Right. But he wanted a copy of it. So I escaped there. But he was very supportive of our ability to not be, censored.
Well, and I'm not surprised to hear that about Wally. I had the good fortune of getting to know him a little bit before he passed away, and I'm not surprised to hear that he did that. You know, first thing is you, if you're a college president, you have to have a bit of a thick skin. You know, not every decision you make is going to be well received. And sometimes you have to be humble enough to recognize you get it wrong sometimes. And people are going to point that out. And so that's part of it. The second thing, observation I make is that we live in a country where we encourage freedom of speech. We want our students and we want our citizens to voice their concerns and also to voice their approval. And so if we do something to discourage that, we may think at the time, especially if we feel offended by what's being said, that that's the right thing to do. But I think in the end, that's not the right thing to do. You know, that's one of the great strengths of this country. And I think it has to be reflected in our academic institutions as well. We want people to understand civility. We want them to understand responsible behavior. But we also want them to feel free to say what they think needs to be said.
I've been talking to political science professor Tom Kazee, who is retiring as president of the University of Evansville. And we've done our best, Tom, to solve some of the pressing challenges facing our democracy. There are many reasons, though, to be optimistic, as the Republic and our Constitution have endured many trials and tests, wars, recessions, social upheavals, and the transition of power from one election to another. Dr. Kazee, thanks for your insight. And I guess a good message to end on is to make sure folks out there register to vote and be an informed voter. Amen?
I agree completely. This has been delightful, David. I appreciate a chance to talk with you.
Thank you. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport.